My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this program to help us come to grips with the substance of and the fallout from the Supreme Court's decision about the constitutionality of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. I think it's fair to say that few Supreme Court decisions have been as much anticipated or as much debated or of as much importance as NFIB versus Sebelius. That importance is substantive. The law will reshape or at least accelerate the reshaping of the whole healthcare sector. Plus, I'm told it has a few political dimensions to it as well, and we're going to hear more about that. Today, we've really assembled a panel that's well qualified to guide us through a discussion of all of those dimensions of the court's decision and the resulting situation of implementing the law at both federal and national level. We're very pleased to have as a partner in today's program the Kaiser Family Foundation, one of the most respected voices in health policy, and pleased to have both as a co-moderator and participant in the discussion, Diane Rowland, who's the Executive Vice President of the Foundation and the Executive Director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Diane?
Thank you, Ed, and thank you all for gathering today. The first session, I believe, since the Supreme Court ruling, so we welcome you. We know there's going to be many more panels. I think every day I open my email and there's five more panels being set up to discuss the implications of the Supreme Court. I guess we can say today that the only thing that we really know for sure is that every prediction of what the court would do was wrong. And so today we're here to talk about what the court ruling actually did and what some of the implications of that are for the health insurance that was being offered through the exchanges, through the Medicaid program, and the health reform legislation itself. So I'm pleased to have the great panel we have today to both use their crystal balls at looking at the future and to be able to start with at least an examination of what the court actually ruled. So thank you for coming, and I look forward to this discussion.
Great. Thanks, Diane. Just a couple of quick logistical notes. There are materials in your packets, including biographical sketches of the speakers. There's more online. Everything that's on the one-page list of additional resources is on the Alliance website at allhealth.org. There will be, courtesy of the Kaiser Family Foundation, a webcast of this briefing available sometime tomorrow through kff.org, and you can reach it also through the Alliance website. The appropriate time, there are green question cards you can fill out that we can use to address questions to the panel, and there are some microphones you can use to ask them yourself, and a blue evaluation form that we plead with you to fill out to help us improve these briefings as we go along. As Diane said, we have just a terrific group of panelists today. We've got analysis of the court's decision, a look at how one state's preparing to implement the law, and insights into the policy and political implications of the ruling. And we'll have plenty of time for your questions at the end. Let's start by introducing Mary Beth Musumishi. She's a senior health policy analyst for the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. She's a lawyer, law school teacher, expert in disability law, and author of the Guide to the Supreme Court's ACA decision, which is in your packets. And her job is to make sure we all understand the basics of what the court actually decided. Mary Beth?
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you. And I'm going to walk us through the decision and sort of set up how the case got to the court and then what the court actually held. First, just for some background, as you all likely know by now, Congress enacted the ACA with the goal of increasing access to affordable health insurance. And there were several components to accomplish this goal. Building on the foundation of employer-sponsored coverage, including some health insurance market reforms, and the individual mandate, which is one of the provisions that was challenged at the court. The mandate requires people to maintain minimal essential coverage or face a shared responsibility payment, which is a financial penalty in the law. Some people are exempt from the mandate, and others are subject to the mandate but exempt from paying the penalty. The law also provides for health insurance exchanges, which are marketplaces through which people will purchase qualified health plans, and also through which they will gain access to advance payment of premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions to make those plans more affordable. And then finally, the Medicaid expansion, which is the other major provision challenged in the court. The law would expand Medicaid coverage to nearly all people under age 65, up to 133% of the federal poverty level, beginning in 2014. Along with that, Congress provided for 100% federal funding from 2014 through 2016, gradually decreasing to 90% by 2020 and prospectively. Florida, joined by 25 other states, filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the mandate and the Medicaid expansion. There was another lawsuit filed in Florida by the National Federation of Independent Businesses and a group of private plaintiffs. At the court, 13 states and the District of Columbia filed briefs supporting the ACA. And as you can see, the two states in light blue actually were on both sides of the case. Their attorney general and their governor took opposite positions. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Florida struck down the mandate, severed it from the rest of the law, and it upheld the Medicaid expansion. The court accepted the case and agreed to hear four issues. First, was this the appropriate time for courts to decide the constitutionality of the mandate under the Anti-Injunction Act? If so, is the mandate constitutional? If the mandate is unconstitutional, is it severable from the rest of the law? And separate and apart from those three issues, the court also agreed to determine the constitutionality of the Medicaid expansion. On the first issue, this was the only unanimous point. The court, by a vote of 9-0, held that the Anti-Injunction Act does not bar consideration of the case now. The Anti-Injunction Act is a federal law that bars lawsuits that seek to restrain the collection of taxes before they are assessed and due, and it applies to taxes but not penalties. The Supreme Court held that the shared responsibility payment associated with the mandate is a penalty and not a tax because Congress in the law termed it a penalty and Congress's language should control. Seemingly at conflict with that conclusion, the court, majority of the court then went on to hold that the mandate is constitutional under Congress's power to tax. And the court explains this contradiction by saying that while they'll defer to Congress's terminology, labeling the shared responsibility payment as a penalty for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act, that is not determinative for the taxing power analysis. The court went on to say the shared responsibility payment looks like a tax. It's administered by the IRS. You would report it and pay it on your federal tax return. It doesn't apply to people who are not required to file federal tax returns because their income is too low. And it's calculated based on factors such as the amount of your taxable income, the number of your dependents, and your tax filing status. In addition, the court noted that the penalty will raise at least some revenue for the federal government, and that is the essential feature of a tax. It does seek to influence behavior by encouraging people to buy insurance, but it still functions as a tax, according to the majority, because it leaves people with a lawful choice to not do so as long as they're willing to pay the tax. The other two arguments, which had gotten a lot of attention, coming up to the court's decision, the Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause arguments did not carry the day. There was not a majority to uphold the mandate under either of those provisions, as only four justices would have done so. So the court did not need to reach a severability, whether the rest of the law would stand or not, because a majority upheld the mandate under the taxing power. However, four dissenting justices did not find any constitutional basis for the mandate, and they would have gone on to invalidate the entire ACA as a result. Moving on to the Medicaid expansion, this required the court to look at Congress's powers under the spending clause. Congress has long had the authority to place conditions on the federal funds that it grants to states to ensure that they are spent to further Congress's vision of the general welfare. And in this case, for the first time, the Supreme Court found that a condition placed by Congress on federal funding to the states was unconstitutionally coercive. It went on to look at a provision of the Medicaid Act that's been in the law since 1965, which is the enforcement provision that gives the Health and Human Services Secretary the discretion to withhold part or all of a state's federal matching funds if states do not comply with federal program rules. And a majority of five justices held that the secretary may not withhold existing federal Medicaid funds for state noncompliance with the ACA's Medicaid expansion. However, the court went on to say that the secretary's existing authority to withhold all or part of a state's federal funds for noncompliance with other Medicaid requirements remains in place. The result is that the ACA's Medicaid expansion provision survives in the law, but the secretary's enforcement power is constrained. States are left with the financial incentive to comply with the Medicaid expansion given the enhanced federal funding, but the penalty for noncompliance is limited to the loss of Medicaid expansion funds, with the result that all of the ACA provisions remain in effect. This gives you a summary of the vote breakdown. So unanimous on jurisdiction, a 5-4 split on the taxing power as supportive of the mandate's constitutionality, a 7-2 division finding that the Medicaid expansion is unconstitutionally coercive because it put all existing Medicaid funds at risk and states did not have adequate notice to voluntarily consent to this change. And then a 5-4 split again to remedy the unconstitutionality of the Medicaid expansion by circumscribing the secretary's enforcement power. So looking ahead, I'm sure there'll be much discussion about which states will comply with the Medicaid expansion. This slide gives you a sense of where states are now in terms of covering working parents through their Medicaid programs as of January 2012. 17 states cover working parents only with household incomes below half of the poverty line. 16 states cover working parents between 50 and 99% of the poverty line. And 18 states, including D.C., cover working parents at or above the poverty line. And again, remember, the Medicaid expansion will go up to 133% of poverty. And this map shows Medicaid coverage for low-income adults, which is even less generous. There's no coverage at all for low-income adults in 26 of the states. And by contrast, 8 states, including D.C., offer coverage to low-income adults that's comparable to the rest of their Medicaid-eligible populations as of January 2012. So the decision raises a host of implementation issues going forward. Some states delayed establishing their exchanges while the litigation was pending, raising the question of whether states will be ready to establish their exchanges by 2014, now that the mandate's constitutionality has been determined. Will states accept the enhanced federal funding available to comply with the ACA's Medicaid expansion? What coverage options will exist for uninsured adults in states that do not comply with the Medicaid expansion? Importantly, what guidance on implementing the ACA will the administration provide in light of the court's decision? And finally, will Congress act to amend the ACA?
Thank you. Thanks very much, Mary Beth. Excuse me. Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Joshua Sharfstein. A year and a half into his position as Secretary of Maryland's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Before that, Dr. Sharfstein was the second in command at the Food and Drug Administration here in Washington. He has served a stint as a committee staff on the House side, and he's a pediatrician by training, so he brings a great deal of experience to his discussion of what Maryland is doing in the wake of the Supreme Court decision and the ACA deadlines as they are coming forward. Josh?
Great, thank you very much, and thanks for having me. As a pediatrician, I could say I definitely...
There we go.
That's better. Thanks for having me. As a pediatrician, I can confirm that prior to the Supreme court decision, I was sleeping like a baby, meaning getting up about every 90 minutes and, you know, waking the entire house. So I'm going to talk about Maryland's progress with coverage expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Maryland, as many of you may know or may not know, is known as the Old Line State from the American Revolution, a nickname bestowed by George Washington for the heroic efforts of the Maryland Line during the War of Independence. And the way that the line stuck together was something that George Washington noted. So I'm going to talk about what's going on right now in Maryland with respect to the Affordable Care Act with that in mind. You can follow us in Maryland on Twitter to see different things that are progressing around all the different issues I'll be talking about. You can follow our general Twitter account, MD Health Reform, or you can join my mom and three of her closest friends by following me at Dr. Josh S. So this is a picture that was taken while I was still at the FDA, right after the law was passed. And this is Governor O'Malley, Lieutenant Governor Brown, my predecessor John Comers. I think it was the day after the law was signed when the governor launched a planning process in Maryland to determine how Maryland would best use the tools in the Affordable Care Act. And we certainly see the law as a set of tools, not as a guaranteed outcome, but one that can really be customized for states to really really help address the key challenges of healthcare access, outcome, and cost. We had more than a dozen public meetings. There were hundreds of public comments, and that led to eventually two pieces of legislation. This is a brief timeline. It has on here the law being signed, the planning process being launched. At the end of that first 6 months, there was an understanding that it would make sense for Maryland to run its own exchange. And that was something that really everyone who was consulted thought it would be better. And often, interestingly enough, on panels with people from states that really aren't that favorable, inclined to the Affordable Care Act, and they're not doing very much, and they're going to wind up potentially with a federally run exchange, whereas Maryland, which is supportive of the Affordable Care Act, is actually very much moving towards a state-run exchange. So we had the first law set up a governing structure, April 2011, for the exchange, and I'll talk about that in a bit. We very quickly had our first meeting, and we began to hire some terrific staff. That first law also set up a requirement that we study six policy issues in depth and provide recommendations back to the legislature. That those were all delivered on time on December 2011, and there was a second law passed that really set up the policy framework for the exchange, and I'll get into some of that briefly. We're joined here by Carolyn Kotrocki, who runs the Governor's Office of Health Reform and really played the key leadership role in getting those bills through, working with some terrific legislators. Now moving into the future, we're looking for exchange certification January 1, 2013, and October 1st, 2013, we'd like to launch the new eligibility system online and in person and with navigators so that people could actually be enrolled by January 1, 2014. This is our exchange board. We have 9 members. 3 of them are public officials like me. I'm the chair. We have the insurance commissioner, and we have the executive director of our healthcare commission. We have a terrific set of people who are the 6 public members, not state employees. They include the former president of the Maryland Retailers Association, the former director of Social Security, Ken Apfel, who's at the University of Maryland, legal aid attorney, Jennifer Goldberg, Georges Benjamin, the director of the Public Health Association, and Daryl Gaskin, who is a health economist at Hopkins. That's a great group. We recently had our 1-year birthday. And we have meetings. There are not quite as many people in the room when the Exchange Board has meetings, but they're not that few. Actually, we'll probably have 50 to 75 people every single meeting. We work very hard to have inclusive advisory committees. They had each one of those 6 reports had an advisory committee that was providing input to it. It's generally chaired by someone from the business community and someone from the advocacy or the health provider community. We've had well over 100 Marylanders actively engaged, and many of them come to the meeting. So we had this particular meeting out in Cecil County, and probably about 50 people had a piece of cake, or at least were offered a piece of cake. Here are some of the examples of the policy decisions that were made and are represented in the framework. The SHOP is the Small Business Exchange. There was an agreement in the state that we should keep the small business market and the individual market separate. That makes a lot of sense for Maryland because we've had a guaranteed issue small business market, but we have not had a guaranteed issue individual market. So we don't want to disrupt the small business market as the individual market transitions to guaranteed issue. We also pick the right level of choice for the small business market based on a lot of input from insurance brokers and businesses. We adopted an operating model which allows the exchange to set minimum requirements for any plan that wants to participate, and over time switch even to a competitive bidding model if we think that that's appropriate to achieve the goals of the exchange. We set rules that require carriers that are more than very small, sort of medium and large size carriers, that they have to participate in the exchange. They just can't sit outside the exchange and pull the healthy people away. And that had a broad support in Maryland. We structured a navigator program. It's a really interesting concept. It had to be structured because on the one hand, you want to have navigators help people get insurance who can relate to communities that really haven't had a lot of insurance or people who are unsure what insurance is. On the other hand, we learned through this public process that there are risks when people are selling insurance and there are potential conflicts of interest. So we structured a particular type of navigator program that'll work in the individual market and one in the small business market. And we support with a special certification process. Not a full licensure, but we'll be working on those details this year. And we also supported a major advertising campaign around the exchange. We've gotten 3 grants so far, the planning grant, an early innovator grant for technology development, and a level 1 grant. We have just submitted a level 2 grant that's pending. We have some estimates of what we expect to accomplish in Maryland. We have about 700,000 uninsured in Maryland, and we think that the Affordable Care Act, we should realistically over a few years be able to cut that in half and our rate of uninsurance in half. We expect about 187,000 new enrollees in Medicaid by 2020 and 274,000 enrollees in the health exchange for subsidized for coverage, whether subsidized or not. For us this year, we've dodged the Supreme Court bullet, and we're really focused on continuing with our various partners to keep our sleeves rolled up and dig into some of the specifics about how to get this to work. We're building an IT infrastructure that will modernize our Medicaid eligibility system as well as provide seamless enrollment in the exchanges. We are choosing an essential health benefit plan, and we're still waiting for a little bit of guidance from the federal government on this, and nobody's exactly sure what an essential health benefit plan will look like, but I promise that I will dress up like one for Halloween. That's because the decision has to be made sometime in September, so I say, don't worry, I'll dress up. And my predecessor, upon hearing that, said, I just hope you're fully covered. So we'll see. We are also have a committee together, and I apologize to Carolyn and others who've heard that joke about 20 times now. So, we have a committee that's working on a sustainable funding strategy. Our goal in Maryland has not been to rush out and do everything right at once, but actually to be sort of right where we need to be. The first year we did the governance structure, the second year we did the policy framework, now we're working on the funding and the essential benefits with the absolute goal and timeline to be ready according to the law's deadlines. And why are we doing this? This is really about the picture more than the text. This is a little girl named Avery, whose mom actually once worked at the health department, was diagnosed with leukemia while the implementation was going on, and her mom has really spoken out in Maryland and nationally about what it means to her that her daughter can grow up and not have to worry about being denied health care for all the different things that can happen to her because of her cancer. And at every meeting that the Lieutenant Governor and I chair of the Healthcare Reform Coordinating Council in Maryland, we start with a story, somebody who's been directly impacted or stands to gain. The Governor and Lieutenant Governor have made really clear that my job as the Secretary of Health, Carolyn's job, is to use this law to the best we can to really make a difference for people in Maryland, to support our economy. And we've just been sort of working with our head down on that, and I think, you know, we have now have a little bit more wind at our back. This is a report from the Urban Institute that did an extensive site visit in Maryland and did a report in February, basically saying while much work remains, a combination of strong leadership, inclusive planning, and deliberate but aggressive action has permitted Maryland to make strides in designing its reformed healthcare system. So we feel like we're still on that track, and we're looking forward to completing it. Thank you.
Terrific.
8 seconds left.
Duly noted. thanks very much, Josh. Let me introduce our other panel members together, since we hope to encourage a lively discussion between them and between them and the other panelists and between them and the folks out front as well. Excuse me. Sheila Burke is on the faculty at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She's a research fellow at the Malcolm Wiener Center. Wiener. For social policy there. She's a public policy advisor at Baker Donaldson, a prominent firm here in D.C. She served, as most of you know, as Bob Dole's chief of staff in the Senate and as secretary of the Senate. And you may or may not know that she began her professional life as a nurse. Chris Jennings heads up Jennings Policy Strategies, the latest stop in a three-decade career in health policy. He's also co-director with Sheila Burke of the Bipartisan Policy Center's state-based health reform implementation project. He was a senior health policy advisor to President Clinton for 8 years, and he used to hang out just down the hall on this floor of the Dirksen Building as the staff director of the Senate Aging Committee, where he taught me everything I know. And it's worth noting for you that Chris and Sheila have put together and will be featured on a much longer program about the implementation of the ACA in the wake of the Supreme Court decision for later this month. Is it the 30th, I believe? So we would encourage you to be on the lookout for the announcement for that. We decided that we shouldn't hold them to a formal presentation, so we're going to kick off this discussion by asking Chris, if we can. You have a number of clients who are directly affected by this decision. What's the biggest concern you hear from them, or for that matter, from anywhere else, about going forward from here?
We've silenced Chris's mic. He can't
talk.
No,
it's working. It's working now. Well, first, let me just say thank you for inviting us here. It's a great joy to be back in the Senate. And I was just on a panel presentation a couple weeks ago with Tom Scully, and we were introduced that this was going to be a lively and informative discussion. And I said that Tom would be the lively component and I'd be the informative component. In this case, hopefully I'll be lively. Sheila is always more informative. Let me just say, in terms of Washington, what's really interesting about the Affordable Care Act that gets lost, I think, in the national coverage of this obviously polarized environment that we live in, is that the law itself, as it was debated and passed through the Congress, was remarkably broadly supported by who we call in Washington stakeholders, healthcare stakeholders. Providers, pharmaceuticals, health plans, consumer, labor, many business, all supported. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, in Washington, if we like you, you're called stakeholders, and if we don't, you're special interests, but they're all sort of the same. But so I would say that the biggest reaction that you heard from stakeholders post the Supreme Court reaction was, decision, was really, if anything, relief. I wouldn't say joy necessarily, I wouldn't say complete happiness, but definitely relief, because we've really gone through the first two of what I think to be three major rounds of this debate. One, of course, was the passage of the law, The second is the constitutional ruling of its standing. And thirdly, will, of course, be the presidential election. So we're two-thirds of the way there for those of us who want to sustain this law. So I want to stop with that.
Jill, what are you hearing?
You don't have a roster of clients, but you have very good tentacles into the various aspects of health policy.
Like Chris, let me begin by thanking you, Ed, and Diane, and the Kaiser Family Foundation for once again pulling together a group of people to talk about this issue. I have to say, for those of you who are younger than I am, which is most of you in the audience, my earliest memories in this building were my first office, which was right down the hall from where Chris's office was, that used to be the bowling alley. It was sort of a long, strange office. And then I moved up when I moved to the Capitol as Dole's deputy and then chief of staff into what was a former men's bathroom. So just lovely memories of the institution. You know, I'm hearing some of what Chris has heard, which is a certain degree of relief, but also a fair amount of surprise. I think the betting that took place prior to the court's decision around everything from how many times will broccoli be cited in the decision to the ultimate decision, I think we were all caught somewhat by surprise with respect to the Medicaid decision. And so a lot of the conversation has been around what the real implications are going forward of the elements of the decision. Certainly, as Chris pointed out, you know, we're through passage, we're through the court's decision, we're moving on to the election. And I think there is no question that on the street it is a question of elections matter. And the election this fall will clearly matter in terms of what the next steps might be. I think we are, as Josh points out, in the midst of implementation in some cases. But as Mary Beth points out in her questions, not at all clear how consistent that is across the country. And I think one of the things we are continuing to hear is what the continued diversity will be among the states and the enormous variation. The decision with respect to Medicaid certainly points out that you will continue to have that kind of variation, which many people have been very concerned about across the states, as the states make the decision not only on the implementation elements of the ACA, including exchanges, and they are all over the place, but also with respect to what takes place with respect to their Medicaid decision. I don't think we can necessarily look back to the decisions that were made around the time of the passage of CHIP or and the changes to CHIP. I think the economics are different today. I think the states and the dynamic and the politics in the states will complicate that issue. You have a number of players. You have governors who have a point of view, some of whom have been heard already. Rick Perry, the most recent to announce what his intentions are. You also have state legislatures, and in some cases they will be of a different party and a different point of view in a state, and so that battle will ensue. You have state insurance commissioners, you have exchange directors, all of whom may have a different view, all which suggests that the states are going to respond to this very differently, and they are very different in terms of their preparation and their capacity to take on these changes. Federally, I think post-election will really tell us a great deal about how we anticipate going forward. Lots of conversation already, which I'm sure we'll talk about today, about what the next steps will be. You have a decision with respect to the vote this week on the entire bill, but you'll have a whole set of questions around the budget as we head towards the enormous challenges, both with the potential sequester, with the debt limit, with the doc fix, all the things that occur at the very end of the year and going into the next year, and the suggestion that reconciliation might once again be a tool. That, of course, necessitates having agreed to a budget and a conference report and given instructions, unless there are special procedures, as was the case with respect to the supercommittee. So I think what I'm hearing is relief in some cases, anxiety in the case of many others, and a lack of knowledge exactly how things are going to go forward. The questions that Mary Beth laid out for us, I think, lay out some of what those issues will be. Things like the availability of credits in a federal exchange, will they in fact be available? The availability of credits to those under 100% of the poverty line,
the availability essentially of coverage for people who will not, in fact, in states qualify for Medicaid coverage if the states don't, in fact, make that decision. What status will they be in and whether they, in fact, will be eligible for any kind of assistance. So I think there's a great deal left unstated and unknown that I think still leaves us in a position of uncertainty.
Okay. Diane?
You know, Chris and Sheila, we've heard a lot from the states about the budget implications here, but we haven't heard a lot about what the implications are for the uninsured. Many of the states that are talking about not going forward have very large, very low-income uninsured populations, or from stakeholders in those states where the hospitals and others will have changes in their disproportionate share payments and other provisions of the law. Can you talk a little bit about what you think the real battle will be at the state level over at least the Medicaid expansion?
You want to go?
Okay.
All right, I'm going to go. I just say that when I look at, and I was going to address this about the Medicaid specific as it relates to stakeholders, you know, there's one thing when you do an analysis of immediately in the aftermath of the Supreme Court, what you will do or you will not do. It's quite another thing once you look at the tremendous financial, the amount of dollars you will be leaving on the table if you do not take up these matching dollars, which are substantial, obviously, for every state, and particularly for states who have large numbers of people who are uncovered. I think beyond that, I hope we get to the question of if, you know, what happens in the aftermath of the election if it goes in the wrong way from my perspective, because I think we don't have an alternative to address those populations in any significant way, which is, I think, would be very problematic, not just from their standpoint of coverage or non-coverage, but really just to have a stable insurance market that works for the whole country and also avoids cost shifting from the uninsured to the insured. Now, as it relates to the stakeholders, or the special interest. In each of these states, whether you're a hospital, whether you're a pharmaceutical, whether you're a health plan, whether you're a consumer, labor, business, leaving those dollars on the table has tremendous implications. I think that you will see a substantial effort of advocacy within those communities to push all governors and state legislatures to accept those dollars and hopefully do it in their own way, in a state-specific approach, not in a federal exchange necessarily, as Josh was indicating, but as a state-driven model to expand coverage. I suspect, in the end of the day, we'll have a lot more states coming in than we currently are hearing, primarily because I have some confidence in the stakeholders' abilities to encourage legislatures and governors to move ahead.
I think Diane's asked exactly the right question. I don't think we know, but I think, as Chris suggests, the stakeholders who have a great deal at risk, you hear this particularly from the public hospitals, for example, who are going to look at their DSH payments essentially declining with an expectation of having had an influx of a large number of new patients now somewhat at risk. If you assume that some of the early estimates in terms of how many people would potentially fall through the cracks. So I think, as Chris suggests, they'll become quite mobilized at the state level as well as at the federal level in terms of identifying those issues. Similarly, the payers, the insurers, as well as a number of the business groups who will continue to look at the potential of cost shifting if, in fact, that population is not, in fact, covered. But again, I think the elections are going to make a huge difference, and I think the battle will literally be played out on a state-by-state basis. I think it is early. I think there have been some initial reactions which may or may not hold when, in fact, states begin to look at what the implications are. But I don't think we can presume either that they will all come in because they've done it in the past or that they will all remain as they are today. I think it'll be, again, something that's going to play out.
Could I just ask, Josh, for the record, is there any doubt that Maryland will take advantage of the option to expand Medicaid under the ACA?
No.
Okay. That's one.
I mean, it is really a... It, sorry. No. it's a very, very good deal for states, and I think the governor and lieutenant governor actually expanded Medicaid for parents before the Affordable Care Act, seeing that as a really valuable thing for the economy, allowing people to stay at work, be healthy enough to work, and I think it is a really important bridge to the exchange, and I think part of the overall package that makes sense. And you know, the federal support for it is really strong, and it matters not just to the governor and lieutenant governor and to the health officials, but it really does matter to all the different groups in Maryland, the hospitals, the physicians, across the board, to have that additional funding, I think.
And could I just ask one more clarifying question? Both Chris and Sheila mentioned DSH payments, the disproportionate share hospital payments that are scheduled to decline under the ACA in anticipation of enrollment in Medicaid going up. In states where there is no Medicaid expansion, the DSH payments will still go down.
Yes.
Okay. That could have an impact on the stakeholder activity level.
That's one reason. But I want to make another point that I think is often missed in this discussion, which is it's very relevant to what you just asked, Ed. But it's not just the DSH savings. In fact, whether you're a Republican supporting the Ryan budget or you're a Democrat supporting the Affordable Care Act, the one thing that unifies both parties, apparently, is that they want to retain the savings from the Affordable Care Act for either deficit reduction or tax cuts or coverage investments. Those savings from the law that was passed, particularly in Medicare and Medicaid, if anyone's suspecting that when people say they're going to repeal the law, that those savings are going to be reinstated and reimbursement rates are going up, I would say that you're vulnerable to also sales from land in Florida, Texas, that people want to get rid of right now. It's just not going to happen. The savings has already been locked down in every single policy that now currently exists before the Congress. They will be retained, and the consequence will be for those people who supported those savings, or for those people who dealt with those savings, they're not going to get them back, and even worse, it's a twofer because they won't get the reinvestments back for coverage expansions.
Go ahead.
Ed, in addition to that point, which I think is correct, that people are assuming those savings, I think people in the states in particular, and Josh will have a sense of this, and Diane certainly will, and that is there is a growing sense on the part of the states, even those that are potentially not expanding or at least indicated they're not, about how to do a better job of managing their Medicaid program. So there is an enormous amount of interest and attention being given to the duals, to other elements of the program, and some fear that in the absence of a better understanding that they are concerned that they are going to essentially expand at a time when we're not really quite clear how we're going to manage the existing population. And it is increasingly a larger and larger share of the state's budgets. And so I think attention to those issues, irrespective of what happens with this expansion, will still be acute. And that is a desire to understand how better to manage the Medicaid program. And I think you will see, in fact, the NGA is meeting this week, and I know a great deal of discussion will be around the proposal that's been put out for the existing program in a block grant environment. And no doubt all of those issues around Medicaid will come back in play as we look at some of these budget issues, both the new populations as well as the existing populations.
Thank you. I certainly agree that just the sheer size of Medicaid in the state budgets and the challenges that state budgets are having force a lot of more attention to Medicaid. And certainly we are, and the governor is very strongly opposed to a block grant as a solution to that, but there are a lot of solutions out there that I think will get explored. One other point to make on the issue, in Maryland we have a unique way of paying hospitals where everybody's bill, every price that's set in the state, we actually set the prices for hospitals, has an extra fee tacked on for uncompensated care. So you can actually see how much it is. It's somewhere around 7 or 8% of the bill. that's essentially a tax on everyone to pay for uncompensated care. And it's very explicit in the hospital system in Maryland just because of the way the system works. But what the Medicaid expansion allows is for that to go down, because people who are eligible for the Medicaid expansion are not perfectly healthy. They're coming to the hospital. They're getting surgery sometimes. They're showing up at the emergency room at pretty alarming rates. And everybody else, we're all paying for them. And I think one of the key points that people in Maryland really understand is that if that care can then be paid for, then that extra fee or tax, whatever you want to call it, comes down. And it is, I think, in addition to the direct beneficiaries, everybody in the state is a beneficiary when you can reduce those cost shifts.
Pretty good. I think we need to get you into this conversation. My eyes cannot see where the microphone is over there, but I see one over there. And you have the green cards, which you can write a question on and hold it up, and we'll bring it forward and spring it on the panel. We ask, if you do come to the microphone, that you keep your question as brief as possible and identify yourself. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician, an attorney, and a Maryland resident. And my question is for Dr. Sharfstein. No one has said anything about premiums. Now that you're setting up the exchange, are you planning to negotiate hard for those premiums, or are you expecting that competition between the insurance companies will keep premiums under control? Because the level of premiums determines the level of subsidy and how much the federal government is going to have to put in, and how many people will not be covered but not have to pay a penalty because the premium is more than 9.5% of their income.
Right. Thank you for that question. Premiums are obviously going to be of a lot of importance to people. There are two major focuses we have right now on that. One is designing the appropriate strategy to mitigate risk in the exchange. And there's a lot of work going on around that, whether we're going to pick up some part of that at the state level, what the federal government does, whether the state is going to actually add to some of the existing risk mitigation. By that, what I mean is that we don't want the exchange to turn into essentially a high-risk pool where the costs keep going up. And one of the more important things for the success of an exchange is to have a lot of people in it, including a lot of healthier people in it, right? And so getting that right is really important. And that's one reason why, after we looked at the policies, we did not want to endorse competitive bidding right at the beginning, because we want to have as broad participation to get the exchange really off the ground strong. But we will be looking very carefully this year at designing a risk mitigation strategy. The second thing is rate review by the MIA, the Maryland Insurance Administration. So it's not just that insurance company gets to set its rates. They get to propose a rate. It's got to cover their costs. And then they, you know, make their case. Fortunately, because of the Affordable Care Act, we've gotten a serious grant to the MIA. They've hired a bunch of actuaries. They made the policy that they will review all rate increases, not just the 10% rate increases. So every so often, I look at the Commissioner of Insurance in Maryland, and I go, there's going to be a moment where the baton passes to you, you know, because you'll be reviewing the rates. That's a really critical moment, and that, I think, is going to be really important in the short term. The fundamental issue around premiums, though, is really about underlying healthcare costs. And today, you know, Medicare announced another 90 or so ACOs, four of which are going to be in Maryland. Our rate-setting system in the hospital system is changing the way payments are made. I mean, I think the long-term strategy around cost isn't just rate review. It's because, you know, they need to charge the rates to pay the costs. And if you haven't fixed the way the costs and the healthcare is being delivered and paid for, you're not going to ultimately solve costs. And that's why we consider the Affordable Care Act and the exchange one piece in the broader cost puzzle. And some of these other things are probably going to be more important over the longer term.
Thank you.
We have several questions that involve the same issue, which is, what happens if a state elects not to take up the Medicaid expansion?
to people under 133% of poverty, and especially to people under 100% of poverty who are uninsured but currently ineligible for Medicaid. And there's been a lot of myths about how they could get picked up with subsidies, but let's clarify that. Sheila or Chris? Chris?
Well, yes, they can't. certainly under 100% of poverty, and a huge population of people, the subsidies are explicitly, the tax credits are explicitly prohibited to go below. It's interesting to note, by the way, that there was some conversation during the development of the law to allow insurers to pick up those populations through tax credits. And there were two reasons why it wasn't included. The first was that, of course, expanding coverage through Medicaid was so much cheaper than doing it through the private coverage because of reimbursement rates, and it would have cost substantially more. And the second, less reported reason, was that health plans themselves did not want to cover those populations and would prefer that be done through the Medicaid program through more traditional, mostly Medicaid contracting through private plans who are used to those sort of capitated payment arrangements. So that formed the rationale for explicitly prohibiting those dollars to go below 100% of population poverty, and as a consequence, we would have substantially greater numbers of people uninsured in those states that do not opt to take that choice.
That is, Chris has described what I believe to be the case as well. I think the exception to that are those who are aliens in the country and not during the first 5 years of their residency eligible for the Medicaid program. They are, I think, one of the
legal residents.
That are in the country and will be eligible for assistance, but it's that relatively narrow population. So otherwise, Chris is exactly right.
And to follow up on a new question that just came in, that also applies to people with disabilities who do not qualify under the current Medicaid rules, even if they're under 100% of poverty. So it would be any adult that would be an
option. Correct.
Go there. Yes, go right ahead.
I'm Fran Kritz with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Public Health Blog. My question is for Dr. Sharfstein, and that is, I was wondering, this is such a complex set of features. What kinds of steps has Maryland already taken and will you take to help explain some of the complexities to the consumers, to the beneficiaries, so that they feel a little calmer and knowledgeable about what's ahead?
I think that's extremely important, that consumers understand what options are available to them. I think some of the intricacies of, you know, separating the individual and small group market probably are not, you know, necessary to be part of the broad public campaign. But I think that it is really important, particularly for, you know, one of the big challenges, and I think Massachusetts saw this, is the need to use trusted advisors, trusted people in communities to communicate the value of insurance, how insurance works, and really generate excitement around a program. We had actually a consultant that had worked extensively with Massachusetts talk about some of their success. They certainly, I think, by all measures, have succeeded in enrollment and getting people satisfied. I mean, they talked about, you know, their partnership with the Boston Red Sox. At the time, I didn't think we had a chance of a partnership with the Baltimore Orioles, being, you know, because the Orioles weren't doing so well. But now, you know, you never know. In fact, I gave a talk on health reform right across from Camden Yards, and everybody was saying, oh, the Supreme Court's going to say, you know, strike it down. And I said, like, look across out the window. If the Orioles can be in first place, the Supreme Court could hold this thing up. So I think that we're going to have to really do a good job with that to be successful. And it's not just saying go to the website and buy insurance. It's really explaining what it is and connecting, not just through ads, but through navigators and others who are really trusted. And what the model that the Exchange Board is adopting is probably going to be to have one or maybe two large navigator entities, but then an opportunity to connect directly with community-based organizations to do a lot of grassroots outreach to at least, maybe not the actual enrollment, but particularly where we're tracking and not seeing the kind of uptake that we'd like to have.
However, Josh, we do have a question here saying, why is Maryland shooting so low in terms of insuring all or more of the state's uninsured? Why only half?
I don't think it's a question of where we're shooting from. I think it's a realistic assessment of what will happen. It's possible that we could get more, and I think that's certainly what we're going to be trying to do. But I think when you look at who wouldn't be covered, I think undocumented immigrants are maybe a harder population to cover through these mechanisms, for example. And then there are sort of estimates based on take-up of Medicaid that are sort of underlying those estimates. So that's sort of the, the more realistic assessment, I think.
Gary?
Gary Christofferson, Healthy People, former Fed, proud resident of the state of Maryland. Let me go back to politics a bit more. You talked a little bit about the DISH part of it, but let me kind of go a little further on the issue of the governors and what they may or may not decide. One of the things that governors tend to watch and state legislators is the ebb and flow of dollars between their state and the federal government. Those states who choose not to take the Medicaid subsidies or the exchange-based subsidies will see a large number of dollars not coming to their states, but they're still going to be responsible for paying for their proportion of the other states. So just your thoughts on how that might play in governors' and legislators' decisions.
You know, I think it really will be idiosyncratic. It really is going to function as a result of the politics in each state. I mean, much has been made of what the states are giving up, given that it's 100% match down to 90, so you're still substantially above the current federal matching rate on the remainder of the Medicaid program. And again, what the tension and the reality will be between the governors and their legislators, their state insurance commissioners in terms of how they're functioning in terms of the exchange and what's available, I don't think we know how those politics are going to play. Again, I think you're going to see a number of them wait to see what happens in November. Certainly Rick Perry's made his position known. Bobby Jindal's made his position known. You've not heard from some of the others who were part of the lawsuit and who also have high rates of populations that are uncovered. You've heard a little bit out of Tennessee. But in those cases, in Tennessee, you've got the exchange planning going forward. The same is true of Mississippi, where they've been moving ahead and made that decision even when Haley was governor. And so I think it's quite a mixed bag. I mean, in some cases, they've taken the position that they want to have some ownership around some elements of it, the exchange being one. In those cases, they didn't want the feds coming in and establishing. So it will, I think, vary enormously by state. But, you know, the point you're making, which is they're giving up a sizable amount of money, is a point that has been made and much discussed. And again, that will be something that the legislators are going to have to consider. Now, one of the complicating factors, frankly, is that a number of these states don't have full-time legislatures. Most of them don't. And many of them, in fact, are, you know, their legislators don't convene again until next year. And so, you know, in some cases, they have to require the legislator to act before, in fact, they do something. So in those cases, they can't do anything or can do a limited amount of stuff before the legislature reconvenes. So again, it's going to vary all over the place, in my view.
And that's an answer to a question we just had about, will states need to pass legislation to accept federal funds to expand?
Depends.
It depends.
Yes. Hi, my name is Krishna Kavi, and I'm an intern at Congressman Pallone's office from New Jersey. And I know in New Jersey there's a state bill that's trying to be passed that would actually allocate more responsibilities to nurses to in case, you know, this decision actually was passed. So is that a solution that you think is very viable for nurses to take on more of those primary care doctor responsibilities, or do you have any other proposals that I could take back to my office? Yeah, thank you.
You've touched my heart. One of the great debates, I think, that the legislation will result in, which was direct or indirect, as the case may be, is this question of the workforce and essentially the increase in the number of individuals who are going to be seeking care. In many cases, they are individuals who will now have funding who did not have it in the past. And there has been a great debate for some time over what the allocation of responsibilities might be among healthcare professionals. Many of the restrictions, in fact, exist at the state level. And so there have been, the IOM has a report that was out a couple of years ago on the future of nursing that talks about these questions of scope of practice laws, which is in part what you're seeing in New Jersey and in other states to expand the ability of nurses with a certain level of preparation, whether they're nurse practitioners, certified nurse midwives, things of that nature. But there's also a great discussion around a different kind of provider, in many cases, community-based providers. As we move out of the institutional settings into a community-based care and more ambulatory services, there is, in fact, a lot of attention, and the ACA has funding that is looking at the increase in the number of nurse practitioners, looking at community health workers. So I think this question of the healthcare workforce is one that we have struggled with for a long period of time. This has made it more acute because there are potentially more people in the community. And so states are examining their practice acts. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, in partnership with the AARP and in follow-up to the IOM study, has done a fair amount of work. There are action coalitions in now, I think, over 20 states that are looking at ways to essentially advance the opportunities for other providers in addition to physicians in primary care settings. So I would encourage you. Yes. And there is, Chris reminds me, the Bipartisan Policy Center also has a report coming out with respect to workforce. Thank you, my dear.
Just covering me.
But there's a lot of activity in that area. So I would encourage you to look at the IOM report. I would certainly encourage you to look at what's going on in the state action commissions in each of the states. And I'm almost certain New Jersey has one that's operating. But I will also say there is resistance on the part of some provider groups to the expansion of the role of some of these providers. The medical societies in a number of states have been quite actively opposed to expansion in terms of the practice acts. And you also see resistance on the part of some about the increasing the level of education, the entry level to a bachelor's degree for nursing. Yeah. The community college system has been quite active in that. And so a lot of attention to how you essentially ease the ladder, the transition from essentially a degree from a community college to a bachelor's degree and then ultimately to an advanced degree. So lots of activity, lots of interest in that area.
Okay. Thank you.
And we have a question here that's come up around the requirement in the Affordable Care Act that states maintain their eligibility levels until 2014, at which time, when the exchange is set up, they could then change their eligibility levels, although presumably by then they would have been implementing the ACA. So Mary Beth, can you talk a little bit about what the implications of the Supreme Court decision may or may not be on the maintenance of effort requirement for states under Medicaid?
Well, I think the Supreme Court decision specifically talks about the Medicaid expansion. When you go through and you read what the justices wrote, they speak in terms of the provision to expand Medicaid eligibility up to 133% of poverty. The maintenance of effort provision is a separate provision. So certainly states could make the argument that the reasoning behind the majority's decision could be extended, but I think that's not what the court's decision did. The maintenance of effort provision was not affected. In fact, none of the text of the ACA was affected by the court's decision. The court only looked at Section 1396C, which is the pre-existing secretary's enforcement authority, and circumscribed the enforcement authority's application to the Medicaid expansion group.
Rafael Szymanski, healthcare consultant. I wanted to go also back to Mary Beth just to talk about the bigger picture of the Supreme Court's involvement in decisions about Medicaid and congressional requirements. And if you could talk just a little bit more in looking at the opinion, Chief Justice Roberts talked a lot about Justice Ginsburg's dissent. You know, and one of the arguments she says is, you know, where he talks about needing to give states, you know, proper notice that this could happen to them. She's like, well, Congress could decide to get rid of Medicaid, and that would be constitutional. So maybe could you talk about, do you foresee this decision as opening the door for the Supreme Court to be more involved in congressional decisions around eligibility groups and other related Medicaid policies that they had not been involved in before?
Well, I think the only thing that's certain about any of this is that it's full employment for lawyers going ahead, and that that was going to be true regardless of how the court came out. Certainly, you know, this idea of coercion and what conditions Congress can place on grants to states is something that was only mentioned as an aside in two prior cases, one from the New Deal era and another from 1987. And so it's never been sort of the hinge, the hook upon which something's been invalidated. So that is something that's new and significant about this decision. The argument was is that the Medicaid expansion was different, that it was a significant amount of money, and so it's potentially distinguishable from other cases down the road. But I think a lot remains to be seen about which way the courts will go.
But there was also another argument that it was different in terms of the coverage group, that initially the program was looking at, you know, mothers, infants, people who were disabled, and not looking at adults who were low income, who didn't have children. So there was kind of a multi-pronged argument for how this was a different kind of coercive decision.
That's right. So the majority says that this is a change in, not in degree but in kind, that there were certain groups that Congress intended to cover, and this is not, it goes to the state's notice of not having adequate notice that Congress would make a change. And then Justice Ginsburg replies to that and says Congress, when it enacted Medicaid, it was intending to cover the needy, and in her view, that's what the Medicaid expansion does.
Chris and Sheila, we have a question here that asks you to use your crystal ball. So if the ACA survives the 2012 election aftermath, when will there be bipartisan support for making our health system work?
In our lifetimes? There is nothing that would suggest to me that the polarization that exists today is likely to end anytime soon. My crystal ball would suggest no time soon.
Okay, then let's be a little bit more optimistic. if you look back at the passage of many of these laws, the on health reform over the years and the decades, the only certainty was that reform was ultimately reformed. And what I mean by that is, there will be policies in the upcoming, no matter what we do, in the months and years to come that will reform this law as well as Medicare and Medicaid. And when you have those opportunities for engagement and reform that become bipartisan, as I think will have to be next year, because next year, if there is going to be a big, broad agreement, it will necessitate bipartisanship, that some of those changes will result in reforms that result in greater investment in the underlying law. I'm not saying that anyone is going to look back and saying, I love that law. I am going to say that over time it will become more sustainable with broader support. I think we saw that, for example, with the Medicare Modernization Act, with prescription drug legislation at the time of enactment, Democrats were so certain they're going to repeal, and within, now Democrats are different than Republicans. They're always willing to forgive and forget, and they move ahead and they love to legislate, and you know there's a whole bunch of history there. But overall, you've seen that with Medicare. I mean, even at the time of Medicare, there were many people who opposed Medicare who now said, "Oh, Medicare has been cut too much," right? So I have greater confidence, as long as we can make it through this election year, that this law will be sustained and supported with a broader number of people. It will just take a little bit longer.
I feel compelled to. I would agree with Chris that time will certainly bring some comfort with elements of this particular piece of legislation. We've seen that even since the passage of Medicare in 65. Tremendous opposition. My boss, Bob Dole, voted against Medicare in 65, but then subsequently when he was chairman of the Finance Committee and his leader, both in Medicare and Medicaid, supported a variety of changes. So I think that kind of transition does occur over time. I think in this case there will be elements, and we hear that discussed today. There are a number of elements in the legislation with respect to insurance reforms that are and were, in fact, broadly supported by both sides of the aisle and both sides of the body prior to the consideration of the legislation. So there are elements that haven't historically had support from both sides. But I think this tension between sort of the federal and state responsibilities, these issues around the budget, are going to make that complicated. I think in order to get by the tax-ageddon or whatever we're calling the big cliff, there will have to be some kind of a compromise, some kind of an agreement, and that will presumably lend itself to the opportunity to legislate. I think Republicans do like to legislate, largely around issues they care deeply about, perhaps not the same issues that Republicans and Democrats would agree are important. But I think they do, and I think they feel strongly about some of these issues and a role for the federal government as compared to the state. So I think the opportunity is there. Many of the folks who historically, particularly in the Senate, have been largely in the middle. Many of them have left the institution. And so the opportunities perhaps seem to be fewer than they were in the past, but my guess is that will change over time as well.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Barbara Kornblau, the Coalition for Disability Health Equity. It seems people are getting a lot of publicity. The governor is saying we're not going with the expansion. So if they say publicly we're not going with the expansion, can things be fixed privately with waivers? So can they expand to some of these groups that they're publicly saying they're not going to expand to?
The answer is yes. I mean, there is always waiver authority. It's existed in the past, exists today. You know, if they could choose to use waivers for certain populations if they chose to do so. Again, I think you're going to see legislators respond in a variety of ways and the governors respond in a variety of ways. They may assert a particular position, but then their legislators may take a different one. But waivers are always available and have been used quite constructively by many states in the past, and I assume they will continue to be.
I think, though, that there's an issue of whether if you use a waiver, which is under the existing Medicaid authority, whether you can get the enhanced federal matching funds that go with it. And a lot of that will depend on how the department really chooses to implement the statute.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Similarly, there's been a lot of talk about, in fact, Mr. Scully is one of the premier talkers about the possibility of delaying some of the expansion, some of the subsidies. Can the Secretary do that and preserve the higher matching rate by some sort of waiver authority?
She says no. No. She said no.
No. Well, no, but the Congress can.
Yeah.
So. And it could, and it's a viable alternative. The issue really is, again, how long providers and plans and pharmaceuticals and others who have anteed up want to delay the time for which they're giving money and not getting anything back. And also, frankly, what the alternative is for them. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's, Tom would say, of course, there's no chance that it won't happen, you know. So that's what Tom would say.
Well, but I think you've seen on the part of the administration willingness to work with the states. You know, early on it was sort of an all or nothing. Then it became, you know, a partnership opportunity around the exchange issues. And I think while there are limits to what the Secretary can unilaterally do, I think there is a willingness on the part of the administration to work with the states as best they can to make things, because the challenges for many of these states now, in the short time frame available to them, if they had not yet begun and are expected to be up ready to go by the end of 13 for purposes of 14, is going to be a big stretch. And I don't honestly know, Chris and others will know more than I will, but I don't honestly believe the administration ultimately wants to run every exchange in the country. So I think their interest is in trying to partner with the states if the states choose to go in that direction. But I think there are limits to what the secretary can pronounce. Some of it can be done by legislation and would need to be. Other elements, you know, they may be able to negotiate out some kind of a middle ground.
And I'll just say, yes, the administration does not want to have one big federal exchange. I will also say that, look, the after governors make pronouncements like that, you have to find ways to accommodate past statements to make it look like all sides are getting something out of that. And that's the way the world works. And we'll see if there is an ability for the secretary to accommodate. I think time will tell is the truth of that answer.
Hi, I'm Frances Correa with Family Practice News. Physician groups have responded to the ruling in a lot of different ways, but they are all trying to push for getting rid of the IPAB and the decreased payments for physicians under Medicare. What do you think the likelihood is of any of that being addressed, and much less before the election? Is that something that could come up after the election, or I don't know.
That's a
crystal ball, I guess.
That's a post-election discussion. But the SGR is something that obviously has to be addressed to some extent in lame duck, either as a temporary measure or a longer-term measure. Most betting in Washington will be a temporary extension to the next year, so you can integrate that into the larger big package that people are either hoping or fearing will ultimately occur. I know that the physician groups across the board are looking at reforms to SGR, specifically because the members of Congress, if they're going to continue to extend this in a bigger deal, say in 2013, are going to require something that is far more sustainable and not continues to set up this annual fix that physicians hate as much as Congress does. So far, there has been no consensus from the physician community about how best to do that. Hopefully there will be. Finally, as it relates to IPAB, you know, IPAB's a four-letter word to a lot of people in Washington. The alternatives are equally bad. It's the law until it's not the law.
Definitively stated.
We have a question here for Josh. This question relates to, if a governor refuses to expand Medicaid, won't this drive some residents to a neighboring state like Maryland, which has enacted the expansion? And is there some way that the states can work together to try and move forward so that you don't have these kinds of transitions? Or do you think Maryland will just do it alone, or will Maryland try and cajole Virginia to come along as well?
Well, I think the example of Massachusetts, which has managed a successful expansion and has done pretty well economically by a number of measures, is, you know, reassuring that a state can make a step forward without all sorts of unforeseen consequences impeding it. Governor O'Malley talks about the importance of investing in the workforce in Maryland, the importance of the Medicaid expansion and the exchanges as a way to do that. And, I've heard him say that He's ultimately sees successful implementation of the law as a competitive advantage for Maryland, for businesses to locate in the state if there's a real investment in the workforce. So, I think that when he says successful implementation of the law, he kind of looks at me with the word successful. So I I understand we've got a lot to do to get to that point. But I think that, you know, our focus is going to be on doing this as well as possible. We're certainly at my level in discussions with Bill Hazel in Virginia and Mohammed Akhtar in D.C. and different people about what's going on. And we really are operating at an apolitical level. Like, we'll exchange information. There are different things that they're looking at about the law that we'll talk back and forth about. But I think that right now the focus is on, you know, implementing it where we're interested in. And I think we'll have to wait later for any of those other considerations. But I'm not too anxious about it.
Hi, I'm Dave Michaels. I'm with the Dallas Morning News. I wanted to ask for a little bit more detail on the DISH payment reductions. Do states lose all of that funding? Do they retain some of it if the rate of the uninsured does not decline a lot? And then finally, won't Congress be under pressure to restore some of that funding in states that don't take up the Medicaid expansion?
Yeah, you're generally completely right in the suggestions of your questions. But the DISH payment reductions aren't eliminated altogether. There's a percent, about a third left after the full phase out over a period of time. It is embedded in the law, however, so the while states may want to come in and say, I'd like to have those dollars back because I don't have coverage, or some providers would, it's a formulaic provision, so therefore it would require a statutory intervention. To the extent it does require statutory intervention, because it would require a baseline adjustment, it would require an offset unless you want to waive the budget rules. And so therefore, a lot of people would say, you know, you're cutting me to fix this DISH thing when you already had money on the table to give back to me. So it's a harder road to go than just taking the money. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I will tell you, to Gary's question, if you are asking other providers around the states to be cut more to pay for this DISH fix that you're asking for this state, I think it's just a hard ask to make.
Go ahead, Bob. Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. I have a legal question that I guess Mary Beth would best answer. Has to do with the congressional authority to use the Commerce Clause for public health regulations after the Roberts ruling in this decision on ACA. Does this invalidate Congress's authority to use the Commerce Clause for everything in the future, or does this is there a more narrow interpretation of this Roberts ruling?
Oh, I don't think you can say that it forecloses everything indefinitely. So the court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence up until this point had been that Congress had authority to regulate anything that was in the stream of interstate commerce, or that when taken in the aggregate had a substantial effect on interstate commerce. And the majority here looked at another aspect, which is this argument about whether Congress's commerce power can reach inactivity as opposed to activity. And five of the justices adopted the view that going without insurance was not entering the healthcare market. So I certainly, you know, I think there are narrow readings of that and there are broad readings of that. And again, it's subject to interpretation in further cases. It's along the same lines as the coercion question earlier. You know, the court there didn't set out a test, and so this is going to have to be something that's resolved through percolating up through the lower courts to decide, okay, how is this case like the others before it or not?
We have a tremendous number of cards in front of Diane right now. So I would encourage you to go to the microphones if you absolutely, positively have to get your question answered. But in the meantime, some of your questions will be answered.
I think, Mary Beth, this goes back to you. So what will happen to the provisions in the ACA that are tied to the Medicaid expansion? And we've discussed that one. The Medicaid dish reduction still stands. But can you speculate not just on the Commerce Clause broadly, but on what the impact on Congress's powers to change Medicaid in the future might be as a result of this decision?
Well, Congress certainly has changed Medicaid in the past many times since 1965, and the court goes out of its way to note that the past expansions of Medicaid are not invalid, that a majority felt that this one was particularly different, as they said, in kind, not just in degree. I think this kind of circles back to my previous answer, which is the difficulty here is that the court didn't set out a test. It just said we didn't see coercion before in the cases where it had come up, and we do see it now that it's clear in this case that a majority thinks there's coercion. But it specifically said we're not setting out a test today for how we figure out what is coercion. So I think it remains to be seen that there's Congress still retains power, but what the upper limit on that power is going to be the subject of future litigation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is John Flint. I'm from Senator Sanders' office in Vermont. My question is about preventative care in the ACA ruling. How can states leverage the ACA ruling to take steps to address and reduce preventable chronic diseases, which account for many of the costs in the healthcare? Thanks.
Well, I think that the premise of the question is correct, and you're looking at underlying costs, better taking care of people at early on and avoiding the complications is good for their health and it's good for cost. I think that as you think about that, the Affordable Care Act is one piece of the puzzle, and there are tools that states can use. The ACO announcement today, it's sort of restructuring the financial incentives, I think is really important. Recently, I was with a group of clergy in Baltimore, and they were asking me about the Affordable Care Act. And I went in, I'd never met with this group before, and it was about 15 men all in their clerical attire. And I was answering all sorts of questions, and one of them said, "Why is healthcare so expensive?" And I started in on obesity and tobacco, but then I paused and I said, "One reason healthcare is so expensive is that people get paid the more that they do. Every admission gets paid, every surgical procedure gets paid, and the historical way of paying for healthcare in fee-for-service means that you get an awful lot of services, and it may not all be aligned for health. It would be as if each of you were paid by the prayer." Okay, and then there was this really long, uncomfortable silence, and I thought I'd kind of stepped in it. And one guy who, in my recollection, is wearing a cape, but maybe he wasn't actually wearing a cape, but looked like he was sort of, you know, ripped from a Nathaniel Hawthorne book, leaned across the table, put his hand on my hand, bowed his head slightly, and said, "Let us pray." It's a completely true story. And they understood that the driving, you know, when someone with chronic illness like heart failure, if the incentives are set up that every admission gets paid for fully, then you see lots of admissions, and there isn't money to do a good job with preventive care. And I really think that it's a combination of two major things which the Affordable Care Act helps, one of which is restructuring the financial incentives, and the other is investing in public health and having connections between the public health system and the medical system. So in Maryland, we have 39 health measures, goals. We have 17 planning regions, and in each region where the hospitals largely put up the seed funding for planning, we have plans to reduce readmissions, to address health earlier, to look at the highest risk, most costly patients, and figure out how there can be a bridge between the public health tools that we have. And the reason we're getting a lot of participation, a lot of excitement around the state in those things is because of the incentives changing. So it's a combination of both of those things happening at once. So I think from, you know, I'm responsible for the public health department as well as the health reform. I think this is a really historic opportunity to align the healthcare system for health. And I think it's those sorts of things that are really going to get the job done.
Go ahead.
Well, we have a question with regard to the state's fiscal capacity. So the concern here is that states currently are operating under huge financial debt. What are the concerns or opinions about whether they can bear this in the future, and how much of that relates to their tax structure and their tax policy as opposed to their economy?
That's an easy one. I will defer, obviously, Josh, if you want to comment on this, but I think that clearly there's multiple factors addressing each and every state, and we saw an article today in North Dakota. If every state could be North Dakota, we'd be fine. We're not. A lot has to do with the economy, job growth, revenue growth. When revenues go up, then things are become very, very possible. I would note that when you look at this extraordinary level of matching dollars from the federal level to the state, one could make the argument that the states will actually gain more revenue from the federal matching dollars through the hiring of new providers and others to take care of the population through the economic infusion of dollars going back into the states, and then they get revenue that would more than pay for the matching dollars that the states actually have to make, however small they are. I think there's going to be a lot of economic analysis about this over the next 6 months to 2 years to encourage states to move in these areas and to help them make their own judgments as to what's best and what's not. I would project to you, though, that once that type of analysis is done, many states will have a hard time deciding that they don't want to do this. The question will be, though, are we living in a void? But we're not. We have a budget debate and tax debate and debt limit debate and SGR debate that are coming up in the fall and into the next year, all of which are going to confuse this type of analysis in meaningful, substantial ways. And so to make a prediction or analysis solely based on the Affordable Care Act and its implications relative to states' judgments is a very, very difficult thing to do and probably a little bit short-sighted.
I think, like everything else, this is going to depend on the state. If we look at some recent activity, for example, the state of California that put a provision on the ballot with respect to a tobacco tax, which failed. I mean, I think each state has a different base upon which it can draw revenues, depending on the industry in that state, depending on a number of political decisions in the state, and is similar with respect to their spending. So I don't think it is simply a function of the ACA, as Chris points out. There will be a lot of discussions around what happens with federal tax policy, as well as how the states are addressing revenue sources in their own state. But I think one of the other concerns on the part of the states, which is not entirely misplaced, is a fear that having committed to an expansion, as provided for under the ACA, notwithstanding the 100% federal match, which declines to 90%, which is still a far better match than exists today, that the federal government has and the Congress has a history of changing its mind. And there are scenarios that people suggest could well play out where the Congress looks to the Medicaid program and Medicaid spending for the source of some of its reduction in spending. So the conversations around block grants, for example, or a variety of other changes in terms of what the federal government's prepared to put on the table. I think there's a fear among some that they will, in fact, change their mind some way down the road and that the states will be left accountable for whatever's in place, notwithstanding the change in federal matching rates. So I think it is, as Chris points out correctly, it is a very complicated question, not simply as a result of the ACA, but because of many of the other factors that will be in play at the state level as well as the federal level that will complicate this question going forward. But certainly revenue policy, having been on the Senate Finance Committee staff for a number of years, I can assure you it will be a very complicated set of questions. I can remember sitting in front of the Finance Committee and presenting on Medicare and having a limited amount of interest, and the next guy up was the tax guy talking about butterfly straddles, and everybody kind of woke up. So the tax discussion will be a very involved one with a lot of trade-offs, and the same kind of conversation, I think, occurs at the state level. Josh?
I was just going to add that I think what matters a lot at the state level is how people relate to the underlying problem of healthcare costs. If people see healthcare costs as just an issue for the state budget, it's just about Medicaid, then, like, you know, a dollar extra in Medicaid, regardless of whatever benefits, becomes a problem. But increasingly, I think states are realizing it's not just about Medicaid, it's about the private sector cost growth, it's about the impact on business, and then you got to think more strategically. And I think to the extent that states are able to think about that, they'll realize that, you know, having a coverage system is really important, and it's a piece of the puzzle of the overall cost problem. And just having, you know, one out of three, you know, and some, I think there's a state with one out of three non-elderly adults uninsured, is going to make it very, very hard to turn the corner on costs over the long term. And hopefully we'll have enough breathing room from the federal budget discussions to allow the kind of the cost curve to bend. But it's going to be really important in states, I think, that are able to ask, you know, kind of frame the right question and be as aggressive as possible on that cost are going to be in the best situation.
Diane has just a couple more questions that we have time for in the allotted time that we have. I would ask you to pull out your blue evaluation form and fill it out as we listen to these last couple of questions and answers.
One of the questions is part of what the Affordable Care Act and its predecessor, the stimulus legislation, did was to put in to place streamlined eligibility and enrollment systems for the Medicaid program, as well as a new way of calculating eligibility. And the question is, will these stand regardless of whether the states take on the new expansion or not? And how are these helping to improve Medicaid generally? Josh, do you want to?
Well, the legal question may be for Mayor Beck. I get to answer the second question.
Well, again, this is a good example of where guidance from the administration is going to be incredibly helpful. But again, going back to the text of the court's opinion, the court talked about the Medicaid expansion, specifically the provision of the ACA that would require states to expand eligibility to those above or up to 133% of poverty. So it didn't talk about MOE, it didn't talk about streamlined eligibility and enrollment or any of the other many, many provisions in the ACA. So I think that's what we know now, and we're awaiting further guidance from the administration.
I would just say that from our perspective, streamlined eligibility is and really what it represents is leaping over several generations of technology to have a truly modern eligibility system, which has all sorts of benefits, including reducing fraud, better access for people, easier access from home, all sorts of mobile implications. So we're really excited about it. It's one of the most challenging parts at an operational level is to build that system, but it has enormous value, I think, to the state.
Okay, and the final question, if a state decides to let the federal exchange operate instead of the state, is there any role left for the state there, or does the state just get to watch?
Well, we don't yet have final details on the federal exchange, but at least my impression from the information on exchange formation that has been provided would suggest that there are continuing conversations about what the role might be with respect to the state. There was a particular sensitivity around Medicaid, for example, and in the streamlined process and who makes those decisions ultimately. But my expectation is that there would be expected to be some role. But again, until we get further details from the administration, I think it's difficult to know how fulsome that role will be.
And I just say, personally, I don't believe a federal exchange can be as successful as its potential without state involvement. States know who their people are, they know how to target at them, they know how to message them, communicate to them, and it would be a mistake not to.
I just say I think HHS has actually been extremely supportive of states in a lot of different ways, and I think the movement in this direction has been really welcome. And I think as states increasingly in the wake of the Supreme Court decision decide to get back in the game, I think they'll find the federal government willing to meet them, whether it's halfway, three-quarters of the way, 95% of the way, and I think that's a good development for states.
If you have a quick last question.
It can be a quick question. Thank you. It was mentioned earlier, Mary Beth highlighted very accurately, that the legal profession is at full employment moving away from this, but something that a recent Forbes article noted is that the insurance brokerage profession is not so certain. Can anybody briefly discuss how or what you see with your crystal ball where the private brokerage profession, which is a substantial portion of the economy, where what role will that play in these new exchanges moving forward?
Well, the early indication, and Josh can respond for Maryland, but the early indication of statements that are made is to underscore the importance of agents and brokers. The expectation, I think, on the part of many states that they would become an active part of the process in terms of advising people with respect to content in the exchanges. The NEIC has been very active. There was a discussion at some point as to whether or not to put out a formal statement. The Secretary, I believe, issued a statement that underscored the value and importance of agents and brokers. They are an enormously important political force in many states. It's not unusual to find state legislators who, as a sideline, their real job is actually as an insurance agent or broker. So I would expect that they would continue to play a role. The extent of that role, I think, is unknown. It'll depend on the state. But I think the expectation is that there will still be activities for them to engage in with respect to the exchange or the enrollment of individuals.
Briefly, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, what I've said to the many different agents and brokers that I met with in Maryland is we've got a big challenge to cover a lot of people. We have some great tools now. And if I were a Martian that landed in Maryland, I said, like, who's going to help me, you know, accomplish this? People who know how to sell insurance, who understand the value, who can explain it, and who also know about the importance of controlling costs because they see that when people can't afford it, our natural allies. And in the policies that we put forward for the Maryland Exchange, we have preserved the ability of insurance brokers to sell in the exchange. They just have to take a training course. They don't have to become navigators. We work that out. They're very excited to participate, and they see it as a way to expand their market. So I think, and many of them have served as chair, several of them have served as chairs on our various committees and are very engaged. I was at a brokers conference at one point with several other states on a panel like this. Maybe there were 500 people in the room, and there were some, you know, people who weren't, you know, the biggest fans, I'll just say that, of the Affordable Care Act there. But the Maryland brokers got up and said they were really excited about it. They appreciated being included. And I think that it's sort of a bit of a symbol in that, to me, in that, you know, there is obviously a big political fight going on around healthcare in this country. At the level that we're working in Maryland, where we'll sit down with anybody and we're trying to figure out how best to work it out, there's a lot that can be accomplished, and there's a difference in areas where they really haven't had those conversations and areas where they have.
And I'd just like to say that for this whole stack of questions, you all did a marvelous job of two or three of you asking something that was almost the same question. So we did manage to get through, I think, the bulk of your questions, but the resource list also provides a lot of information to give you some more detail than what we were able to do today.
That's absolutely correct. And let me add my thanks to Diane for your good participation at all levels in this and for your feedback on those evaluation forms. Let me thank the Kaiser Family Foundation for its obvious contributions to the conversation and its co-sponsorship of the briefing overall, and ask you to join me in thanking the panel for an incredibly useful beginning to this conversation.